It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
In Virginia, your license can be suspended for failure to pay debts related to any conviction, not just traffic convictions. We have found only 8 other states that suspend licenses for failure to pay both criminal and traffic debts.
Angela Cholfi at the Legal Aid Justice Center talks about the lawsuit challenging the loss of driver's licenses for not paying court costs and fines, a practice that has caused more than 900,000 Virginians to lose their driver's licenses. And during this week's News You Can Use, we'll talk about a new collection rule for fines and costs, which may resolve many issues in the lawsuit. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 297, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and online at www.wrir.org and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. The Supreme Court of Virginia has added a new rule establishing standards for courts' collection of fines and costs. The rule comes amid criticism and a federal lawsuit focusing on how court financial obligations and driver's license suspensions affect needy offenders. Advocates for the poor call the system in many courts a debt trap. The court issued new Rule 1:24 on November 1st to be effective February 1st. The new rule is intended to ensure that all courts approve deferred and installment payment plans to promote predictability, fairness, and similarity in the collection of fines, court costs, penalties, and restitution throughout the courts of Virginia. The rule provides that a defendant unable to pay up within 30 days must be offered either a deferred payment plan, a modified deferred payment plan, or an installment payment plan. A court cannot deny a payment plan solely because of a prior default, a collections referral, a lack of payment history, a particular type of offense, the availability of a restricted license authorization, or the total amount of all fines and costs. Defendants must get written notice of all payment alternatives. All fines and costs may be incorporated into one payment plan, the rule provides. A required down payment must be a minimal amount to demonstrate commitment and to facilitate entry into a plan. Down payments for obligations more than $500 are capped at the greater of 10% or $100. The payments and schedules should be a reasonable amount and time, considering all the financial circumstances of the defendant. Where available, the court shall liberally use community service work as an option to defray fines and costs, especially when the defendant is unable to make substantial payments. The new rule acknowledges that the system is broken, said Angela Cholfi, senior attorney with the Legal Aid Justice Center. The Supreme Court deserves our praise and thanks for its leadership in helping people avoid the court debt trap, Cholfi said. The new rule offers tremendous potential to stem the tide of drivers entering the license for payment pipeline. While the rule should help, a fundamental flaw remains, she said. The rule does not alter the mandatory and automatic nature of the driver's license suspension statute. The U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly said that states can't punish people for failure to pay unless the default was due to an intentional refusal to pay, Cholfi said. Nearly 1 million people have lost their licenses without having been offered a payment plan. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright.
Most of us discovered the problem of fines and fees or court debt when my colleagues in the Civil Rights Division issued their report on the Ferguson Police Department after the shooting of Michael Brown. The investigation in Ferguson exposed the municipal court operating as a cash cow for the city rather than as a fair and impartial tribunal. The investigation found overwhelming evidence of minor municipal code violations resulting in multiple arrests, jail, and added fees and assessments that could, for example, convert an original fine of $150 into one well over $1,000, insurmountable debt. Emails produced during the investigation talked about the need to, quote, fill the revenue pipeline. Officers were instructed to take ticketing to, quote, the next level or risk disciplinary action. The municipal court, which was only in session one day a week, imposed fines and fees without ever inquiring into a defendant's ability to pay, and then the court issued warrants for the arrest of people who didn't pay. In Ferguson, a city of just over 21,000 people, the court issued 25,000 arrest warrants in a single year. When we at the Office for Access to Justice read the Ferguson report, we immediately realized that Ferguson could not be alone. And as we started to investigate, we also realized that advocates around the country had already discovered this problem. Both the ACLU and the Brennan Center had written reports about court debt and some of the more abusive practices that courts had engaged in to collect that debt. Our research quickly revealed the breadth and depth of the problem, and I will tell you it's difficult to overestimate. There are approximately 6,500 municipal courts in the United States operating in 34 states. Although they go by different names, such as city court, justice court, or mayor's court, some states have just a handful, others like Texas and New York have thousands. Typically, these are courts of limited jurisdiction, and many of them are part-time. In 28 states, one does not have to be a lawyer to be a municipal court judge. Some state courts are unified so that the highest court has supervisory authority over their municipal courts, but in other states, the municipal courts truly act independently. Well, many of these courts operate fairly and in accordance with basic constitutional principles. Others routinely incarcerate people simply because they cannot afford to pay the fees and fines imposed for minor offenses. Some jurisdictions even hire private probation companies to supervise people who cannot immediately pay the fines and fees imposed. These companies are, quote, offender funded. The companies charge extra fees on top of those assessed by the court. And the companies have a clear financial incentive to use coercive measures to secure payment, such as longer probationary terms, threats of incarceration, and additional surcharges, because typically they offer their services to the court for free in exchange for retaining a percentage of the money they collect. And the problem is not restricted to municipal courts. State legislatures have increasingly turned to court fees as a way of funding government. And so fees in all levels, of course, are increasing, as are the tactics the courts have employed for collection. And in some states, they have even turned to children to finance the court system. The Juvenile Justice Center just issued a report on fines and fees in juvenile court, where sometimes it's children, sometimes their parents, and sometimes both, are legally liable for fees for things like probation, the cost of testing or assessments or counseling. In California, where the decision to impose juvenile fees and in what amount is left to the discretion of the counties,
fees range from an average of $4,895 in Sacramento County to zero in, of course, San Francisco County. In Alameda County, the average for all children is $2,861, but for black children, it's $3,438, and for white children, it's $1,192. Without question, courts have the authority to punish an individual who willfully refuses to pay a fine. But back in 1983, in a case called Bearden versus Georgia, the Supreme Court held that putting a person in jail for failure to pay a fine without first determining whether that person has the ability to pay violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. This, according to the court, would, quote, be little more than punishing a person for his poverty. The court went on in Bearden to say that if a court finds a person cannot afford to pay their court debt, the court must offer alternatives like community service. Jailing people as a means of collecting debt is not only unconstitutional, it's also misguided public policy because, as you all know, practices like these erode public confidence in law enforcement and the court system. Jailing people because they're poor contributes to mass incarceration, and it comes at a substantial cost to both taxpayers and communities. Jail for trivial offenses costs people their jobs, parents are separated from their children, and families are left in dire economic straits. Even in states that don't incarcerate people who fail to pay their fines and fees, there are other consequences. The most common, which you'll hear about, is driver's license suspension. If you fail to pay your fines or fees, or if you're on a payment plan and you miss a payment, your driver's license is suspended, often without a hearing. And obviously what happens when you suspend someone's driver's license is, well, if they don't drive, they probably lose their job or they'll be unable to get their children to school or to the doctor. And if they do drive and they're stopped by law enforcement, they'll get another ticket for driving or, worse, be put in jail. Poor people caught in this cycle can never get out. They stay poor and they get poor. So we at the Department of Justice decided to take some action. In December of 2015, last year, the Department and the White House convened a two-day meeting of advocates, judges, legislators, court administrators, and federal officials to address the problem and discuss potential solutions. Our goal was to help state and local courts address these complex issues and engage in reform. At the same time, we created a resource guide for fines and fees, which includes articles, reports, and ideas for reform, and posted it online. We announced that we would be participating in and contributing funding for the National Task Force on Fines, Fees, and Bail Practices, which was created jointly by the Conference of Chief Justices and the Conference of State Court Administrators. Finally, and probably most significantly, the department sent a Dear Colleague letter signed by Vanita Gupta, the head of our Civil Rights Division, and me. And that letter went to every Chief Justice in the country and every state court administrator. The letter addresses some of the most common enforcement practices that, in our view, run afoul of the Constitution or other federal laws, including incarcerating people for nonpayment without first determining their ability to pay. The letter also discusses the importance of due process protections, such as notice, and in appropriate cases, the right to counsel. We also talked about the need to avoid unconstitutional bail practices and due process concerns that are raised by certain private probation arrangements. The letter is posted online, and we hope you will all use it as a resource and a tool. I think it's fair to say that the response to our actions has been remarkable. There has been extensive media coverage, including stories in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, on CNN and NBC. There have been op-eds in major newspapers around the country. ABA President Paulette Brown devoted a column in the ABA Journal to the issue. Perhaps most, for me, satisfying were two op-eds written by two municipal court judges, one Ed Spillane in College Station, Texas, who wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post entitled, "Why I Refuse to Send People to Jail for Failure to Pay Fines." And he talked about alternatives that he used to both jail and driver's license suspension. And Judge Marcia Murray, the chief district court judge in Durham County, North Carolina, who wrote in the Durham News an op-ed entitled, "When Traffic Court Becomes Debtor's Prison." The department has also responded to numerous requests for additional information about these issues and have tried to reach out to constituencies who were not represented at our initial meetings in December. I spoke and moderated a panel of chief justices on fines and fees at a White House forum on access to justice. And for me, what was most notable about that forum was Chief Justice LaVarga of Florida, who gave an impassioned speech about why driver's license suspensions make absolutely no sense as a means to enforce fines and fees. In addition, there's been concrete action by state courts. There have been new rules adopted in Texas and Missouri directing courts about how to do ability to pay determinations, what kind of notice has to be provided, and numerous other good measures taken to make a difference in the collection of fines and fees. The National Task Force on Fines and Fees is also at work developing a lot of model tools for courts to adopt around the country, including bench cards for judges on ability to pay determinations, model tickets that would include notice that if you are unable to afford your fines and fees, you should go to court or seek assistance with a payment plan, training for judges, model ethics rules, and a whole host of other initiatives that we think will make a difference in these practices around the country. We are now going to hear from Angela Tulsi, who is going to talk about what a non-LSC program is doing in this area. Angela?
I'm going to talk chiefly about the Legal Aid Justice Center's Drive Down the Debt campaign, which, and actually if you could move to the next slide, great, which strive to dismantle Virginia's abusive license for payment system. Every year, Virginia traps hundreds, actually if you could go back, hundreds of thousands of low-income residents in debt and poverty by suspending their driver's licenses for failure to pay court costs and fines. Nearly 1 million Virginia drivers currently have suspended licenses for failure to pay. For many drivers, that means giving up their only mode of transportation to work, forcing them to choose between losing their jobs and risking jail time for driving illegally. As Alexis Harris pointed out in Pounds of Flesh and others have pointed out, enforcing debts against people who can't afford to pay puts them in a perpetual state of punishment, one that losing their driver's license only exacerbates. They can never atone, especially compared to wealthier people who can just write a check and be back in good standing. In Virginia, your license can be suspended for failure to pay debts related to any conviction, not just traffic convictions. We have found only 8 other states that suspend licenses for failure to pay both criminal and traffic debts. Moreover, low-income debtors have no opportunity to demonstrate that they can't pay because of their poverty. Suspension is automatic. In most courts across the Commonwealth, the DMV computer simply talks to the court's computer, identifies any accounts in default, and poof, the DMV issues the suspension. No one has to do so much as even push a button. Driver's license suspension is Virginia's form of debtor's prison, effectively leaving people confined to their homes in many areas of the state where public transportation is unavailable. And as Lisa Foster pointed out, for those who drive on a suspended license, which traffic safety experts estimate is approximately 75% of people, it can lead directly to incarceration. In Virginia, driving on a suspended license is a criminal offense carrying up to 12 months of imprisonment and a $2,500 fine. A third or subsequent offense carries a mandatory minimum term of imprisonment for 10 days. A shocking 88% of driving while suspended convictions are based on suspension orders issued for defaulting on court debt and not for being dangerous behind the wheel. And then, of course, a driving while suspended conviction results in more and more costs and fines. This is Kimberly. She came to Legal Aid because she'd lost her food stamps because she lost her job. She lost her job because she lost her license. And she lost her license because she got a minor traffic ticket for speeding that soon spiraled out of control with interest, fees, and other compounding charges. After getting pulled over for driving while suspended and bald tires she couldn't afford to replace, she walked 11 miles each way to the courthouse to ask for a payment plan, only to be told she had to pay the full $1,200 she owed in order to get her license back. When she finally got on a payment plan and got her license back with a little help from not fewer than five lawyers, she had to sell her blood plasma in order to make the first payment because she had not yet received a paycheck at her new job. She then lost it again a few months later after a clerical error sent a notice of suspension to the DMV, triggering a $145 reinstatement fee and putting her new job at risk. So what can we do about this literally blood-sucking system? The Legal Aid Justice Center is a non-LSE program, and so we are able to do lobbying. In 2015, we succeeded in passing legislation that required Virginia courts to publish their debt repayment policies online. Prior to the legislation, it was virtually impossible to find out what a court's payment plan policy was or if they even had one. As courts rushed to write and publish their policies, we worked with the Judicial Council of Virginia to promulgate guidelines for repayment policies that courts could use to improve fairness and consistency. In 2016, the General Assembly passed legislation requiring payment agreements to comply with the rules of the Supreme Court, which have yet to be promulgated, even though that legislation went into effect this past July 1. We worked with members of the committee developing the rules, which actually included legal aid lawyers, to advance policies that are fairer to low-income debtors. We expect the new rules to be released any moment now and are eager to see if the provisions we fought for and that they fought for survive the rulemaking process. The 2016 legislation also provided a process for waiving interest accrued during periods of incarceration, which previously could not be waived unless the debtor was incarcerated on the offense accruing interest. Meanwhile, we used the publication of the payment plan policies to grade the courts on compliance with the new Judicial Council guidelines, and here's what we found. Notably, 81% of general district court, that is our municipal and traffic court, of GDC policies make no reference to a need to assess a debtor's individual financial circumstances. In 64% of GDC policies, the amount of the debt and not the debtor's financial circumstances determine the amount of time a debtor is given to pay. We also found that few policies took into account debts owed to other courts, few offered community service in lieu of payment, and many required substantial down payments. Some policies also made it very difficult for debtors to get back on a payment plan after default. Needless to say, the majority of Virginia General District Courts appear to have disregarded or fell significantly short of the Judicial Council recommendations. Some of them did not even comply with the legislative mandate to post their policies online, despite the Supreme Court's efforts to provide a website where they could easily be collected and posted. So in July, we filed a class action lawsuit against the Commissioner of the Department of Motor Vehicles calling for an end to the practice of automatically suspending driver's licenses for failure to pay. Our complaint alleges that these severe and coercive policies are discriminatory and violate the fundamental principles of due process and equal protection. This is Robert Taylor, one of our four individually named plaintiffs. Robert has spent many days in jail for driving while suspended, all stemming from running a red light in 2014. He actually paid what he owed for that conviction, but not until after his license had been suspended, sparking a downward spiral of debt, joblessness, homelessness, and incarceration. The lawsuit asked the federal court to strike down the license for payment law as unconstitutional, order the defendant Department of Motor Vehicles Commissioner to stop suspending licenses, and to reinstate the licenses of all drivers who were penalized for inability to pay. Despite widespread consensus that license suspension is cruel and counterproductive, we were disappointed to read the state's motion to dismiss that was filed just this past Monday. The state has moved to dismiss on both procedural and substantive grounds, essentially saying although it may be bad policy, there is no way to challenge it in court, or at least in federal court, and it is not unconstitutional. Our response is due November 3rd. The case and the problem of license for payment generally has gotten a fair amount of media attention, including this op-ed from Omar Epps last month. The op-ed also spotlights outstanding work on this issue by advocates in California, Texas, at the Brennan Center, and elsewhere. You can download our complaint, the state's motion to dismiss, and other materials on our website at justiceforall.org/drive. I hope you will consider taking on this issue however you can through individual cases, advocacy, or litigation. Since the complaint was filed, we have received an outpouring of calls from people who can't get out of the court debt trap. We've heard the strain and desperation in their voices as they describe how they have had to choose between paying the court and paying rent, how they can't find or keep jobs because of unreliable transportation, and how they have had to go to jail just for driving to work. Thank you.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. The difference between the rights and benefits for employees versus independent contractors varies tremendously. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Laura Collins at the Virginia Workers' Compensation Commission explores the problem of misclassification of workers and what to do about it. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wakeman.